You're listening to That Life Then. Les Mouches, New York City, 1980. Written and read by Jack Merrill. On my 21st birthday, I moved from Chicago to New York City, sleeping in a sleeping bag that had last been used for high school camping trips, now unspooled on the wide planked hard wooden floor of a teeny, dirty tenement apartment on West 28th Street just off 7th Avenue. My first weekend in the city, I was wandering around the West Village when I came across some posters plastered on a wall saying something about Patti LuPone performing at a nightclub called Les Mouches. I'd seen Patti LuPone in Evita on Broadway, and apparently she was belting out a late-night cabaret show at this Les Mouches club on Saturday nights after she performed in Evita. The address of Les Mouches was listed as 11th Avenue and 26th Street. As my dirty little dump was on 28th, and Patti LuPone was doing a late show that very night on 26th, I figured I'd walk over and see what was what. After all, I did need a job. The club was up on like the fifth floor of an old, run-down, lofty-looking building located all the way down by the Hudson River, in an area which back then was mostly empty during the day and completely deserted at night, other than a thicket of leather bars a couple blocks below 23rd Street and the loud transvestite drag queens who patrolled 11th Avenue till dawn. The building took up the whole block front facing 11th Avenue, and the entrance had been cut down to a glass door with almost no lobby. It was just a gray, small space leading to a plain, fluorescent-lit elevator, which opened directly into the club. Once inside, I was hit with the sour smell of stale cigarette smoke and spilled booze. The place was dingy in that depressing way any nightclub is when the sun's up. It's like seeing someone you thought was sexy in an unforgiving light. There was some guy clinking bottles behind a wall-sized bar, and he looked up long enough to point me down a hallway lit with a few overhead bare bulbs. At the very end was an office and a bald guy with a handlebar mustache sitting behind a desk in a white t-shirt. When he stood up to shake my hand, I couldn't help but clock his tight leather pants topped with a big belt buckle. Scrutinizing me, he said his name was Carey. He was the manager of the club, and he waved me into a seat as he leaned back against the front of the desk. He asked me where I'd worked in a way that was mildly interested and totally bored at the same time. I told him I'd just moved from Chicago, where I'd worked at some of the coolest and chicest late-night clubs the city had to offer. He leaned back against the front of the desk with his laconic air, nodding and staring from behind that big-ass mustache, and then he casually undid his belt buckle, reached into those tight leather pants, pulled out a big flaccid dick, and proceeded to half-heartedly yank on it. "You want to suck my dick?" he asked. "No," I said. I want a job." He kept yanking on it, flopping it up and down while staring at me. "Are you sure you don't want to suck my dick?" "Yeah, I'm sure. I want a job." He stood there for a minute, then put his big floppy dick back in those tight leather pants of his, did up his big belt buckle, and said, "Can you start tonight?" I could, and so began my first job in New York City. People didn't ride dirty elevators through nondescript loft buildings and deserted neighborhoods patrolled by drag queens to get up into a nightclub back in Chicago, but I figured I'd give it a night. At least I'd be able to see Patti LuPone's show. They didn't need me till around 10, and by the time I arrived dressed in my tight black nightclub worker getup, the place was buzzing. Now there were people everywhere. The club had high ceilings and took up the whole floor of the block-long building. The front part, straight off the elevator, held a warren of lounges, leading to a disco with a big dance floor surrounded by step-like carpeted blocks where people could lay around doing their coke and spilling their drinks as they vibrated to the bone-thumping music. Towards the back was the cabaret. The cabaret room was remarkably quiet, considering the pounding going on up front, and must have seated somewhere around 200 people at round tables of 10. There was a good-sized kitchen behind a long stage with swinging doors on either end. The kitchen was as brightly professional as any restaurant kitchen I'd seen back in Chicago, and going through those swinging doors from the dark club into the pristine, shiny food line was a bit of a shock. The overall aesthetic of Les Mouches was black, 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 with maybe some gray. All I remember about the decor was that most everything was painted black, like the club was designed to recede behind its patrons. Big Floppy Dick Carey had managed to assemble a large staff both in and out of the kitchen, and the whole operation reminded me of one of those overcrowded trains you see in pictures from India. It may have been packed to the rafters and most likely dangerous, but when it was time to leave the station, the whole operation lurched forward, everyone grab onto something or someone, and whoosh, off we'd go. I was expected to jump aboard with a minimum of questions and not fuck up. I figured I could do that no problem. The deal was simple. Late night dinner and a show that started after midnight, and it wasn't cheap. Dinner was a set menu of a couple courses, the first being a salad. I had to quickly take drink orders and ask which choice everyone wanted for dinner, and I couldn't fuck around because the whole place filled up in minutes and everyone needed everything now. I had to negotiate all the food at my tables on big oval trays stacked high with large round dinner plates, racing through those swinging doors on either side of the stage and out into the loud bustling room. Everyone's dinner was supposed to be eaten and cleared before the show started. I'd handled loud, busy rooms filled with pushy, needy customers, and had carried my share of stacked, overloaded trays. But the guys who worked at Les Mouches, they were something new. There was a long staging line that went the entire length of the front of the kitchen, and behind it were mostly burned-out-looking, crusty, older gay dudes who may or may not have seen better days. The waiters struck me as extremely worldly, in a world-weary way, and handsome. Very handsome. Really handsome. I'd never seen such a collection of handsome older guys. Well, everyone was older than me. I mean, I was used to that. I'd been working in clubs for 3 years already, and had just turned 21 not a week before. There were a few cute young things closer to my age, but everyone was older, and many strikingly handsome, in that stand-out-in-a-crowd-yet-beat-up kind of way. Like, yeah, they knew it, and yeah, so did everyone else. But okay, so what? And what now? The thing they all shared was an uneasy feeling of being untethered. At sea, in spite of seeming like the kind of men who were supposed to be the pride of our country, they looked to me like guys who should be filled with promise. These are the kind of men that got the girl, that got the good jobs. Men who were at ease socially and had a variety of underlying talents and possibly some brains. The kind other guys secretly envied. The kind of men who looked like they'd been groomed for success. Only there was a problem. These guys weren't interested in all the girls everyone wanted to fix them up with. No, these guys were interested in each other. This was not a small problem. This was a huge problem. Every day somebody would ask them, why aren't you married? Where's your girlfriend? When are you going to settle down? But they couldn't settle down. They weren't allowed to settle down. What they were allowed to do was mortify most everyone they'd ever met in their entire lives just by living. They couldn't stick around pretending, not with everyone's eyes all over them. And they weren't just going to sit there and try to pray things away. No, not these guys. Their only choice was to run. And run they had, all the way to New York City. Theirs was the first generation who had whiffed the stuff of freedom. As long as they moved somewhere else, that is. As long as this newfound freedom was around the corner, just out of sight, so as not to make others uncomfortable. This crew had bolted wherever it was they'd grown up to live in a big, unfamiliar city, where excuses could be made and realities glossed over, or best yet, ignored. And there, they would meet other guys in similar situations, and they would have sex. Finally, lots of it. Breezily accepted, uninhibited sex. Because what's a better fuck you to those bigots back home than having the most amazing sex possible with the most beautiful men on earth? And why not do some drugs while we're at it? I mean, why not? These guys would never be able to live life as it was supposed to be lived. So why not break all those rules everybody back home was so intent on enforcing? They were breaking them already just by being alive, so fuck it, right? So they'd build glittering party palaces and dance and drug the nights away, forgetting all that bullshit that made them hate themselves in the first place. And they did. They took drugs, and they fucked beautiful men, and they danced the nights away with total abandon. For a few years, anyway. And here they were, working at midnight at this latest escape called Les Mouches, this collection of battered beauties. Far from home, going it mostly alone, and short on cash. But these guys didn't quit easy. Nope, far from it. In spite of everything, they were filled with energy and invention, and they still saw possibilities. They had ideas and dreams, and they'd grown to love New York City as they transitioned into New Yorkers themselves. I loved watching them and listening to them talk about their lives. There were a few I could barely bring myself to even look at. Yeah, I'd learned to be careful about looking too long at handsome men. You had to be smart about it. While mostly I'd been lucky and rewarded for my interest, there were a few times I'd misread the situation and almost gotten punched in the face. Or worse. It took time to sink in that all these different kinds of men were actually gay. They all got it. All of them. They'd been there. They understood. And it was okay to stare. Well, not really. I mean, I couldn't be creepy about it. But at least it wasn't physically dangerous. There was a broken boy who reminded me of the redheaded kid from the movie Fame, only more busted up inside and better looking outside. He followed me home after my first night at Les Mouches, and we slept this close in my sleeping bag on the dirty wooden planks of my pathetic new niche. As soon as I put my arms around him, he started crying about how tough and mean New York City could be, and how he wanted to be an actor and was taking classes at Udo Hagen's studio. Whoever that was. It turned out he cried a lot. But not that I blamed him. Most all the gay guys I'd met were damaged in one way or another. For a cute young gay guy out on your own, it wasn't easy to make friends or get anyone to take you seriously. Gay people were considered nothing more than a frivolous footnote to most straight people, and finding gay friends could be fraught with sexual tension. For young guys, there were added fears about abusive and predatory men. He gave me backstories on the guys at work. Who was deep into drugs, who was rough in bed, and who was just flat out mean. But he also reverentially pointed out who was talented, and which guys had performed on Broadway and in movies, and how he couldn't believe any of them had to work at Les Mouches slinging hash in the middle of the night just to make ends meet. I'd been considered pretty wild in Chicago. Up most nights till dawn, but New York City was another level. Here you had to be careful. I could see how this city had pounded some life out of these guys. New York could go faster than any of us, and if I didn't look out, I could get trampled underneath all this newfound freedom. I was desperately attracted to many of these guys, but I kept my distance. See, I wasn't about to be treated like some plaything. I might have looked innocent, but I was a tough little fucker. I'd made it this far, and I didn't plan on ending up like any of these guys when I reached their age. I watched them, and I listened to them, and I learned. I learned that they wore wedding rings when they went on auditions or job interviews because, quote, nobody wants to hire a fag in the real world, no matter how good he is for the job. And when it's a fag who's doing the hiring in show business, it's even worse. I learned that a few of them had been married and then divorced for obvious reasons, and that many harbored large reserves of anger towards their families and even women in general for causing them all this heartache and humiliation. I learned that they all knew each other somewhat. The crowd was only so big, and that although there was plenty of snark, they begrudgingly respected and watched out for each other. The guys working in the kitchen were different than the waiters. They were tougher, sweatier, and not a little spent. Some of them were really sexy. The redhead told me that the guy who lined up salad plates on the stainless steel counters had been in porn movies, and when he looked at me and smiled, I believed it. That smile of his reverberated through my entire body, but I never went near him. Well, it's not like I didn't want to. Believe me, I did. But something kept me away. There was an edge to this world these guys lived in that scared me, and I went from wild Chicagoan to mild New Yorker almost overnight. The guy who ran the kitchen was mangy and shined with a coating of thin sweat covering his fucked up pockmarked skin. He'd leer at me saying, "Hey, how's the pretty new boy tonight?" in a way that wasn't meant as a compliment. I'd known guys like him. Mean, angry creepers who wanted to take you down any way possible. He'd bang plates around, swearing at us new guys. The older ones would just wave him away, telling me to just ignore that old troll. But he ran the kitchen and was impossible to avoid. One night, he was making sausage and called me over to show me the pig's intestines he was stuffing with ground meat. He said, "You see this? You see how thin this is? That's what it looks like up that pretty ass of yours. So you better be careful about who you let shove their fat cock up inside you. You could rip. That's how these hot shots around here are getting all these diseases. Save it for someone who cares." He was telling me this in the most perverted way possible, but coming from his dripping dreadful self, I heeded his warning. Everyone was talking about diseases. Stuff I'd never even heard of. Scabies and amoebic dysentery and hepatitis. Nobody in Chicago was talking about any of this. I thought people living in huts somewhere in the jungle got such things. It made me wary. Plus, I thought if I gave myself randomly to these guys, sex would lose its value. Like I only had so many shots, so to speak, and I wasn't going to waste any. And also, you know, I wanted to fall in love. I knew it was possible, even in all this craziness. I pretty much kept to myself, although I did have an ongoing thing with that redhead. I didn't make a habit of hanging out after work, as you never knew where one of those nights was going to lead. This crew got invited everywhere, and whenever I wanted, I could join them. But that meant up past dawn for sure. Cocaine wasn't yet addictive. Quaaludes were still the party favor of choice. Not a word was heard about a 12-step program. And AIDS was just the name of some appetite-suppressing diet candy sold on late-night TV. You had to be a bad boy in the first place to want to work a midnight show at a throbbing nightclub on deserted 11th Avenue. And all these guys loved the nightlife. The shift started late, ended fast, and we were all paid decent dough, mostly in burnable cash. If I thought the waiters were sophisticated, the clientele blew my mind. I just come from working at one of the chicest private nightclubs in Chicago, where the most glamorous woman was a well-known aging drunken heiress who clung to the front bar covered in the biggest rocks I'd ever seen. But people like her came in every night. It wasn't long before a laughing Elizabeth Taylor strolled off that shitty elevator with a smashed Maureen Stapleton in tow, wearing what I now know to have been the Krupp diamond sparkling on her hand, spraying light all over that rat-trap disco cabaret at well after midnight. It was thrilling. Everyone who was anyone at that moment in New York City found their way into that cabaret room to hear Patti LuPone during the months I worked there. I'd never seen a star perform in a cabaret except in old black and white movies on late night TV. And Les Mouches was hardly a bright art deco club with shiny floors where everyone wore satin dresses and tuxedos. No, this was some discarded loft where everything was painted black so the flaws would disappear. This room you could feel. This room you could smell. This was dark and sexy. The waiters blended with the guests in the seamless desire for experience. Patti LuPone was the new vocal force. Not just ruling Broadway, but now crowned the Midnight Cabaret Queen. Everyone had heard about her show, and the town came down. The place was packed, week after week after week. It was electric. The room may have been raucous, but when she got up into her spotlight, the whole place shut up. Every show. She'd point out the famous people in the crowd, making them stand and wave. Most of the names I'd never heard of, but they looked important. And made me feel there was no place better any of us could possibly be. She ended with Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, standing at the mic with a pin spot on her face, releasing one tear on cue every time. One notable evening that didn't include Miss LuPone was when some of the waiters, and I think the guys who owned the club, created a special award for an actor they believed to have been ignored by the famous award shows because of his gayness. I was a kid who didn't know much of anything, and certainly had never heard of him, and found it all kind of dumb. But then the presenters started rattling off this guy's impressive achievements in New York and London and Hollywood, and I began to wonder why they had to create this alternative award night for him. And then he got up and made a speech saying it might seem like a little thing, but this award meant more to him than an Oscar or a Tony ever could, because these were his friends and peers, and they'd gone out of their way for him. And it was so heartfelt. I looked around and some of the Les Mouches guys were crying. And I realized I was crying too. And I've never forgotten him. Although I couldn't tell you his name. That pockmarked creeper behind the kitchen line never stopped yelling and saying perverted things to me. My revenge came when he handed me a plate he'd put together and I saw a fat striped caterpillar sitting on a sprig of green he'd used to dress up the plate. I quickly covered up the plate and the fat striped little fella under the silver covers we used to stack the entrees, and when I got tableside, I picked the most squeamish-looking woman at the tent top and made sure the sprig was facing her. I didn't make it back to the kitchen before I heard the scream. Well, everyone heard the scream. It was impossible to miss. Pockmark Creeper knew I'd seen that fat little fella before I set him down. I couldn't contain my smile when we locked eyes as he got chewed out by one of the owners. I stayed at Les Mouches for a couple months after Patti LuPone moved on. There were other cabaret acts, but the most memorable to me was Donna Pascoe. Everyone knew her as the sad, cheap girl in the rabbit fur coat from Saturday Night Fever who kept trying to get John Travolta to fuck her. I remembered her from the movie as not very attractive and loud and crying with her makeup smeared all over her face. In reality, Donna Pascoe was pretty and nice, much prettier than in the movie, and I'm sure her act was great. But that's not what stood out for me. The last night of her run, however long it was, all the waiters were told to stop by her dressing room before the show. I walked down the long, dark hallway on the side of the club that I'd never been invited to walk down before, And at the end, in a small room, sat Donna Peskow in front of one of those showbiz mirrors surrounded by light bulbs. She turned away from the mirror and asked me who I was, and then gave me an envelope with my name written on it, took my hand, and pulled me down to kiss me on the cheek, thanking me for helping her with the show. She said it was a big deal for her to do her act, and that I'd helped her make it happen. The envelope contained a nice thank you card, and there was a $20 bill stuffed in there, too. All the waiters got a personalized card and a 20. You know, I've often remembered that simple act of kindness. So easy, yet so meaningful. She couldn't have made that much dough from the show, but she'd shared it, and she'd appreciated my help. I knew I didn't really do anything, but she taught me a lesson of kindness. How a simple act can mean so much to someone who feels alone in the world. There was a night when some of the guys convinced me to stay late and dance a few at the disco, and I got a little trashed and jammed my brand new black leather Avericks bomber jacket with a soft beaver collar I thought I looked particularly hot in into a crevice below where I was dancing, and when I jumped down to get it, it was gone. My keys were in the pocket and some of the cash I was perpetually short on, and I had to climb the fire escape on the front of my building at like 4 in the morning to get into my not as dirty but still pathetic little pad. That was it. That's how it ended. I never went back to Les Mouches. It had been great, but I was over it. And besides, I'd been hired to work lunches at the Russian Tea Room.